to the ISCN Smart City Dialogue Podcast. It's the podcast for international knowledge and practice exchange on common good-oriented smart city development. I'm your host, Enoch, and in this episode, we're talking with two fantastic guests from Canada about AI in the urban planning profession, what dilemmas planners face with this technology, how to navigate its expanding scope and capabilities, and what AI means for the role of urban planners in the future. We hope you like it. Let's dive right into it. Hello, Morgan, and hello, Pamela. How are you today? And could you just tell us, to get us started, who you are and what you are doing in real life?
Good morning. Hi, I'm Pamela Robinson. I'm a professor of urban and regional planning at a university in downtown Toronto called Toronto Metropolitan University. I'm also a registered professional planner. So in Ontario, which is the province in which I work, I hold a license to practice planning. My work has always looked at interesting trends from the future and what it means for Canadian cities. And so it's fun to be here today to talk about the work Morgan and I have been doing around the use of artificial intelligence tools in planning and city building. Morgan, over to you.
Hi, Enoch. It's great to meet you. My name is Morgan Boyko. I'm also a professional planner and a community engagement specialist at a consulting firm called Dillon Consulting, which is a planning and engineering firm that has offices across Canada. I am based in Nova Scotia on the East Coast, but I work with municipalities and other clients right across the country. And my focus really is on community engagement in planning. I'm also a PhD candidate at the School of Planning at the University of Waterloo. And there my research focus is really on this intersection between planning and public participation and democracy and digital civic engagement technology. So I kind of straddle this research practice divide. I do this work in communities on a daily basis and then also study it.
Wonderful. Excellent. Yeah. Wow. Great to meet you. And I mean, when we start with the whole AI thing, you know, it's naturally gonna become a huge conversation, I guess. But let's go maybe first down the memory lane. By now, I think it's been more than 3 years actually already that ChatGPT kind of hit the internet and every one of us. To both of you, do you have some memories on that? Have you had any particular thoughts on what this will mean for urban planning? And yeah.
Well, I went back and had a look because I didn't want to engage in an act of revisionist history on a very important podcast. And it was so interesting. I tried to find the first email I sent to colleagues about what ChatGPT meant for us at work. My immediate reaction was like, holy smokes, academic integrity has gone right out the window. I remember thinking also it happened a lot faster than I thought it was going to. But when I went back and kind of reconstructed a timeline, I found a paper from October 22nd, 2017 that got really terribly rejected from a journal called Governments Making Sense of AI. So long before the launch of ChatGPT, the research team that I collaborate with, we were thinking about this. And I actually wrote kind of an op-ed piece the summer before ChatGPT was released about governments and automation and what it meant for government public relationships through public participation. So we knew it was coming, but the way in which it came out, like it kind of caught us off guard. And in my world as a professor, it totally upended all kinds of things, including like at the time it came out, we were using these things called reading responses to help get our students to read more where they would read. And then they'd summarize their readings and share it. And I was like, well, that just killed the reading response, right? So those are some of my first interactions. Morgan, what about you?
Yeah, I had to think back as well. I do recall this feeling, though. I think the first thing that really struck me is just how quickly and eloquently and fluently it, you know, ChatGPT could produce these very large volumes of text. And so that, you know, that matters for planners because we really live in text and language and communication is so central to what we do. So I took a look back in my emails and files as well. And one of the first things I did was, over 3 years ago. It was November 2022, I think it came out. I kind of ran this early quick and dirty experiment where I found a planning report online for a project that I wasn't involved in that had an appendix with actual verbatim public feedback in it related to a transportation planning project, like a What We Heard report. And I took all that and I just ran it through ChatGPT and I asked it to summarize and interpret what the public said. You know, it was hundreds of comments, right? And of course, you know, it spit something out in a matter of seconds. It was very confident sounding. It was very well organized. It totally plausible sounding. And then I compared that against the summary that the human planners had actually produced, and it told a completely different story, right? So I right away, there, you know, I can see two problems in there and issues that I think, you know, we have seen prop up, which is like, first, it just generated kind of generic transportation planning themes as like the main themes of the input, like infrastructure, safety, transit, sustainability, kind of textbook stuff. But it wasn't how the community itself talked about their concerns. So I think then the second problem I saw was I actually told the ChatGPT to use the themes that the planners used to analyze the data. But it came up with completely different counts of how often stuff came up, the importance it ascribed to certain topics. So it looked like analysis, but it wasn't really the same kind of analysis that the planner would do. So is this more that pattern matching stuff? So that's, I think, for me, when I realized this is more than just sort of another digital productivity tool. Like, if it can really convincingly produce the wrong interpretation of something, I think that's, right. I could see the stakes for planning in there.
Right. Yeah. If I can add to that, I just remember also that it was both exciting, but also stress inducing for me, like in an exciting way, of course, but I would see all those feeds, you know, and every now and then a person would just also, again, confidently, similar to the AI, state, oh, look, I found this new use and like 2 months, you know, down the road already, this is going to change everything and whatnot. So I'm super happy that, you know, after the initial big hype, maybe we're still in some hype cycles left, but then still that, for instance, you guys structured the whole thing a bit more. So also through your work, you set up, you developed some game on the planner's dilemmas. You also wrote papers on this. So maybe could you lead us a bit through this whole process of actually structuring what AI means in the urban planning?
Yeah, I can. I'll talk about the planner dilemma cards first, I think. You know, I think we and like a lot of other planners, like we immediately saw the, you know, the potential impact of the technologies. So, you know, what we're trying to do here is give planners sort of a safe and kind of structured way to work through what are these ethical gray areas. And the technology was moving really fast, but we didn't have sort of professional guidance to keep pace. So it was actually Pamela that came up with this idea of riffing on the old 80s card game Scruples. So we created this card deck where we present realistic scenarios, not extreme hypotheticals, but the kinds of decisions that we thought planners would be already facing with the technologies that already exist. And we have a whole range of across the spectrum of risk and complexity of different little dilemma scenarios. So like as an example, you know, say one of the dilemmas is you've collected thousands of open text responses from a community engagement process, you know, something that happens to planners all the time, but you don't have any budget left to do the analysis. Your project budget is spent. So do you take all those comments and run them through a free AI tool, or do you do a much more limited manual analysis? And then we get planners to kind of have a conversation about this. And that might be an easier one for some to answer, but it's sort of, it speaks to the pull of AI. Or like another more complex one we have is an AI tool could help you predict which framing of your engagement questions would lead a less confrontational response from the community. So do you adjust your questions to like surface less antagonism in the community? But this gets trickier because, you know, you're talking now about using AI to shape the terms of public debate. So we've run this kind of card game in multiple sessions now, and we've found that, you know, planners are, there's some that are super eager to adopt AI, and then others that are like quite vehemently opposed on principle, really. But I think most planners we talk with are somewhere in the middle, and they're trying to figure out where those lines are. And so with the cards, we're trying to prompt the sort of conversations that help us explore where those ethical lines might be a little more collectively.
Can I just jump in? I want to add a couple things to what Morgan's already talked about. Like, you know, one of the things that's been interesting for us is that we made these cards open source and we've shared them. And so the hope is that, because people are like, oh, you could make money. We're like, no, we want to have a conversation, right? And I think when Morgan and I have done these workshops, and we've done 4 of them now and have 3 more lined up in the next few months with planners, it's for sure people's favorite parts, right, Morgan, where people really just want to figure out together around a table, how on earth do we make sense of both this innovative opportunity and the sticky parts of it that are hard for us? So in the deck of cards, one of the things we have is ones that are blank where people can add to the scenarios. And Morgan and I are constantly adding. But the other thing that's happened is that, you know, I think we're going to now make a gallery of retired scenarios, because when we started, and Morgan, when we wrote that paper, we were asking questions like, should you let AI tools help you edit your writing? And now that's just a default in all the platforms we work with. And so there's this incremental addition of this capacity to everyday tools, which means some things that were active decisions 18 months ago or 2 years ago aren't anymore, right? And so I think keeping track of the things that are no longer actually active decisions is going to make this super interesting. I think the other bit is, like, in a time of rapid change, the rules around what's okay aren't going to keep up with the technology. And so there's this kind of migration from what's the code and what's your conduct, right? And we're trying with these cards to really ignite people's active thinking at their desk or in their back pocket, whenever in a public meeting, like, when is it okay? When is it not okay? When should I pause? And people really need that creativity and the thinking on their feet. Hey, Morgan, because you would know this, you're in front of the rooms of people virtually and in real life all the time, but there's a lot of thinking on your feet, right?
Yeah. So mm-hmm. It's this idea of giving people the opportunity to work through what are real scenarios they can face in their work, give them an opportunity to work through that and discuss with others in advance so they can be more prepared.
Right. So first major takeaway already, Pamela, thank you so much for having highlighted that this in effect means that also people out there can reuse those cards, right? So true to the spirit of open source, feel free to reuse those. We will also share the resource materials and links in the show notes later on. That's fantastic. And I think often enough with all these workshops and now also trying to catch up professionally with this, we underestimate actually the potential of really coming together in presence and discuss this and play. The definition of dilemmas is that there is no real way out. Now, Pamela, you already said that sometimes actually this way out just so happens, you know, without our say, like you say, in these fast cycles of AI, very quickly some of these dilemmas seem to be decided already. Sometimes, on the other hand, maybe people do have an epiphany or like some elegant way of actually solving this dilemma of theirs. Have you had any such instances where actually, you know, people solve these dilemmas or freed themselves of them or like acknowledge that then maybe soon there will be a way out of it? Or
Morgan, I would say like one of the big things we hear is that people would like some guidance from leadership. Right. And so it's not that they don't want to engage in the dilemma, but I think that I would say people are trying to balance like their obligations to community really carefully. And some of the things like people's instincts say like, oh, I don't know. And they can't quite put their finger on it. So their wisdom or their professional expertise is making them question, but they don't, I think they're a bit nervous about like they don't want to look like they're anti-innovation, but they also don't want to make a mistake and cause harm, right? And so I think there's this funny tension. And I think one of the tricky things about people's everyday access to these tools is that they're in all of our hands, but the guidance around what's good really shouldn't be like it's individuals, it's too much work for everyone individually to have to figure this out. We could use some bigger, higher order guidance.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think it just speaks to the nature of how unique this technology is. And I think unlike other technology innovations or waves, that it was an obviously powerful or consequential technology that immediately got put into individual hands at the professional level in absence, as Pamela said, of kind of guidelines, guidance from our professional bodies or even from our employers. And then all of a sudden, individual planners were enabled, empowered to use these technologies without that guidance. So I agree. I think that there's a desire for more guidelines from our professional bodies or our employers, but that's going to have to happen through the conversations. These professional bodies are our professional bodies. We need to have the conversations. What people have found is they can work through some of these dilemmas when they're in conversation with others around a table. But in absence of those conversations, it's much harder to sort out these dilemmas individually, or in absence of talking with the community that you are working on behalf of. That's the other side of it.
I think that it'll be interesting, though, to see like the municipalities who I think are really going to demonstrate leadership right now are going to be the ones where they carve out space for people to bring their what if questions forward and to create sites for experimentation inside where people want to try to see what can happen. We had this really robust civic technology movement before the pandemic where people used to meet once a week and work on collaborative projects together. I think there are elements of civic technology that will come out of this new easy access to AI where people are trying to build tools and experiment. And I have lunch once a month as part of this Canadian Municipal Community of Practice, where AI folks from coast to coast to coast in Canada, we've met once a month for lunch for the last 6 years, where municipal staff bring forward the things they're working on and talk about it and bring forward questions. And, places like the city of Edmonton, one of my favorite early AI deployments, it's kind of esoteric, but Edmonton has all these wildlife cameras across the city trying to understand the relationship between wildlife and human development. But there's hundreds and thousands of hours of video footage from these trail cams that they have no capacity to analyze. So they trained an AI to identify wildlife in the video. And it wasn't taking away work from people because they just couldn't do it, but it was basically like a community science project to try to figure out what things were. And they had hilarious stories about like trying to differentiate between coyotes and dogs, for example, or like, is it a deer or an elk, or is that a human or a Sasquatch? So anyway, it was a good example of technological advancements help this local government who made the space for their staff to experiment, build a new tool that gave them good evidence. So I thought that was a good one. But on the flip side, I think this technology is raising questions around like, is this my job? And that's like my favorite dilemma card that we have is one where the working title is this my job? And it says, at a public meeting, open house, a local resident approaches you in your role as a planner and shares that their government-provided income supplement has been terminated and they think it's a result of a bad decision that came from automation. What do you do as a planner? Is this your job? Right. And that's an interesting one because the public meeting might be like about a park or something, but a resident's asking you for help. Right. And so I think as these tools become more and more available, they change the boundaries of what are we supposed to do and what's our human obligation versus our obligations at work.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. That's so, so fascinating. Can I add to that what you described earlier, Pamela? So I think indeed, there is the big dilemmas looming large also further down the road, and certainly we'll have to address them. But what we also in the ISCN sort of try to highlight is such cases, either from civic tech or from municipalities themselves, where actually due to human creativity, we find also sometimes elegant solutions, like really going around those dilemmas and really reframing the solution and finding neat new workflows. So just to give an example of that, we had little German municipalities, you know, out of desperate need, like they cannot, you know, buy tokens for super expensive data centers. But what they did, in fact, was really to recover old GPUs in their basement, you know, and then trying to run models locally, which then initially, of course, you know, throws the whole dilemma around data protection and, you know, does this go to some commercial interests away, and you stay first with an exploration of actually the potential of AI as a tool. Now, others are going to say, of course, well, you're not going to make the race with some local little tools in the end. But I think it does show, you know, the potential and merit of actually mapping out what is the big dilemma that you really cannot sidetrack, but at the same time, inviting local creativity, solutions, and also the smallest beautiful take on all that.
I've been teaching university students since 2000, and I've taught so many classes on so many different things. And one assignment that I use almost in every single class I teach is a final assignment called "What Can You Do with What You've Got from Where You're At Right Now?" Right? And it's an incredibly durable series of questions, but this question of like, do you see something that needs attention? Okay, noted. Now what are we going to do, right? And, you know, sometimes there are long-term solutions, but sometimes we just got to go with what we've got right now. And so I love that idea of like going down to the basement. Every place has a closet full of retired stuff, right? But that kind of like local ingenuity is so important. And one of the questions Morgan and I talk about all the time is like, these large language models are so generic, right? They're migrating things towards common themes. But those unique place-based solutions and opportunities are things that we don't want this large process to smooth over or erase.
Yeah, and I think that's the one of the challenges that we surface with AI technology is its promise to smooth things over, make efficient the work that planners do, you know, and we know planners are, there's a lot of pressure right now on the profession. You know, Enoch, you mentioned the housing crisis earlier, there's climate impacts we're trying to help cities deal with, austerity, budget cuts, public engagement is becoming much more difficult, sometimes, you know, even unsafe for the planner. So I think it's in that kind of context where you have these powerful tools that are promising speed and efficiency and control and rendering these messy processes more manageable, you can see how that is extremely tempting. But for participatory planning processes, that friction that's in the process is the point in itself. The more slow process, sometimes it's difficult to navigate, you know, different perspectives, disagreements, different power dynamics in any one community, but it's through that process of navigation where you sort of build the understanding and work with the community to get to the right solutions. So it's in those spaces where, you know, the trust has to get built manually between, you know, community members and the decision makers, and it's in that space that people feel heard. So we're just cautioning against automating away too much of that difficult work that planners help to facilitate and help communities to navigate through. And planning itself has quite a dark history here, when, you know, the profession really embraced much more technocratic and sort of efficiency above all mindsets and approaches. So I think that we just have to caution against a return to that technocratic mindset with really powerful AI tools. And I think this isn't going to be just like this one dramatic moment of replacement where AI is just going to replace all planners and replace all decision making around city building. We're seeing, as Pamela mentioned, you know, this kind of gradual automation of the different sort of human functions. You know, now it's like every one of our software platforms has just built in AI to help you, you know, refine your writing. that's just a thing that's happened now, and we don't question it even anymore. But each of these steps towards automation might kind of seem reasonable individually, but then, like, what's happening collectively? Are we hollowing out, you know, the participation process? So when in our some of our writing, we call this slippery slope of synthetic democracy, right? So it's this kind of incremental drift of letting the machines do more and more of the relational work of that democratic planning process.
Right. And so you've talked more about community engagement, right? Like as one of the use cases for using AI, really. How does that pan out there, maybe, you know, like this slippery slope there? Do you have some like tangible maybe examples of that, or how that could happen, and then how to maybe stop that, prevent that, you know, and then maybe is there even some red lines, you know, to formulate to really not let the solutionism of AI encroach on everything here, but to meaningfully use it?
The way in which technology, it's a huge intervener between local government officials and residents. There are all of these online public engagement platforms that exist. They predate AI. They've been around, what do you call that time post 2010? In the 2010s onward, it's not the aughts, that's the decade before. They've been around, and you know, they've centralized opportunities to have conversations about what might happen in community. They look really good, like they're colorful, they're fun, they don't look like boring government tech, right? They have different tools on them. So there are things like polls and commenting for maps and discussion boards and other ways to kind of keep track of engagement material. And these tools have been around, that's like Morgan's PhD, but these tools have been around a long time. And so they've made things both easier. But Morgan, do you want to talk about the friction and the dissent part, like what they've done there?
Yeah, and again, it just goes to that previous point about rendering a process more manageable. And this isn't some nefarious thing or some ill intent on the part of planners trying to, you know, smooth out all disagreement and make sure that, you know, a predetermined outcome is the only one that gets selected. But it's just the nature of how some of these technologies are constructed. They're sense-making, they bring order to these messy spaces and try to make them more manageable. But what that can do in practice is it can often unintentionally, you know, exclude certain people from a process. You know, if your feedback doesn't fit in to this templated, you know, approach that like a digital platform really encourages. So then you lose certain voices in that. Or if there's real vehement disagreement and rightfully so in some of these processes, community members can be angry and very dissatisfied with the process or the proposals. It's much easier through digital tools to sort of smooth out that disagreement or excise it from the process while making the process itself look very open and transparent. And, you know, look, we've got this great website and tool and we're inviting thousands of comments, and we can produce these reports that demonstrate openness and transparency, but we just have to be careful of those tools still bracketing out certain parts of the conversation or structuring the conversation in a certain way. And so I think that's linked to the AI technologies that are increasingly getting layered on to these processes or these platforms. I think AI can really supercharge that issue.
Right.
And I think we could say, like, these platforms really structure participation, and there are lots of things about that are really helpful, but also things that we need to be careful about. But, you know, AI is really structuring the interpretation, right? And so what we're doing is taking the human work out of making sense of what the public thinks. And that's not a good trend, I don't think. Like, but it's hard for municipal staff all around the world are facing pressure to do more with less time. We have austere budget environments. We also, in planning, at least here in Canada, like, we're being blamed for the housing crisis because there's too much red tape and we want things to move faster. And one of the things that takes time in city building is working with the public. And so there's a lot of political pressure to make that process go faster. But faster doesn't always mean better. And I think we need to collectively really stay attuned to what does it mean to prioritize efficiency over deliberation and real engagement.
Yeah, and Ina, I think just to go to, you had asked about the red lines piece, and I think that that's really interesting, maybe to give us, you know, something concrete. And it is towards the bottom end of that slippery slope, but you can see where these pressures that we talked about that planners are facing, you can see where the things are potentially heading and the way the technology is heading. So I think the clearest red line for us is saying no to synthetic participation. So that would be replacing real community members with, you know, AI generated proxies. And this is not a hypothetical either. Like this, the technology is there. The intention is there to have, you know, the people call them silicon samples or virtual publics. So we're just warning that these AI tools can't diminish the value of, you know, individual contributions, real community contributions, or like fully replace that human interaction. And we're seeing research coming out trying to enable this, like already very much in the marketing space and in some social science research. There's lots of experimentation going on with using LLMs to replace human participants in research, that kind of crowdless crowdsourcing. So that's being explored very seriously, but you can very easily migrate that logic over to planning, right? So using AI to simulate what the public would say instead of actually asking them, right? So we think that's maybe a good fundamental red line that we got to be careful not to cross.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I would say actually this is a red line that calls out on the whole promise that's been given, you know, on behalf of all those AI developments, because if there is anything that actually should come out of using it, is to have more free space, I guess, to invite real life interaction. So it's kind of ironic, not to say cynical, if actually, you know, the trend goes exactly the opposite, replacing the human even more and more in that.
And I want to just briefly introduce sort of this other
aspect we've been having from this exchange between smart cities and AI use in France and in Germany. We've seen one mapping there where we had seen exactly that most of the local municipalities are now trying to be more efficient, right? To actually have established processes just much, much more quicker. And then basically barely anyone thinks about what to do with the freed space actually, because you have to deliver on the efficiency. And then there is a whole blind spot, you could say, and rarely anyone is actually thinking about new and creative ways maybe of using AI use, right? It's all so much skewed towards the efficiency bit, but not towards introducing new processes or also new skills. And that leads me actually maybe to the question in kind of the last bit of our conversation here. Is there, now that you've engaged already and will be engaging with urban planners and collectively kind of reflect on how AI will change the practice, is there some skills indeed, you know, or some, yeah, that need to be honed further, that will reemerge, that we need to put into new focus as we have more and more outputs by AI? So is there anything that you see in the practice really changing in the near future, given that this technology is introduced there? Is there any new skills or any emphasis that urban planners should put into their profession with all this?
You know, I've been arguing for a long time that planners need better critical data literacy skills, right? I mean, planners have always worked with data. It's an evidence-informed practice, but what that means in this age of AI becomes really important. And so we need to unpack that capacity. You know, I think everybody needs to be better aware of bias detection, right? Our planning school at TMU is in a faculty with nurses and midwives and social workers and early childhood development folks. So we're a very human-centered faculty. We're called the Faculty of Community Services. And I have a near future fantasy that we're going to have a course for all of our students about AI bias, because the folks that we teach are going to be frontline working in community. And they're going to be the ones, it's always frontline workers, right? It's social workers and librarians and teachers. If something's amiss in community, they start to see it, right? And so I think raising people's awareness about bias detection and also having a place to flag that concern, you know, to the question around back to the dilemmas card, like if a planner had a community member say, like, I think I'm being impacted by bias from automated decision making, where do you go with that concern, right? There's no maybe an ombudsperson. If you call 311, like, are they going to know what to do? So, you know, creating systems to receive concerns about bias that actually work and recognize people as humans, not a chatbot, would be really important, I think. We need people to have real knowledge of place, I think. You know, one of the things that we really have to continue to give oxygen to is people's connections to real places and real people, but also people's deep knowledge of place, because that's, you know, the robots aren't going to be able to do that anytime soon, right? There's always data, but the context of the data matters. And so keeping our places alive and well and people's connections to real places matter. And I'll also say that we need, you know, this is the transition over to you, Morgan, we need people to commit to mentoring the next generation of people who are going to do the work. One of our biggest concerns right now is that large language models can do lots of the first draft writing that people used to give to junior staff or to interns. And, you know, people who work on the consulting side, those efficiencies may be beneficial, but if we don't invest in the next generation of our city builders, there's going to be nobody to continue to do the work up the line. So mentorship, I think, and commitment to helping people build their early skills is really important.
Absolutely. The, you know, if AIs can automate all those sort of simpler tasks, those are the tasks that, you know, a planner, a junior planner will traditionally learn through. So we're risking this hollowing out of that kind of apprenticeship model. And we need a way for junior planners to learn the norms of the profession. So I think the most important skills right now are not necessarily the technical skills. They're much more the human skill, the communication skills, emotional intelligence, empathy, you know, the critical thinking. Those have always been, and maybe perhaps even more so now, are essential for the work that planners do and for us to successfully work with AI. Pamela mentioned that deep connection to place, right? So the planner should, you know, they know the community, they know its history, its power dynamics, the relationships. That planner should be able to spot when an AI output doesn't ring true, right? So that kind of local knowledge, that's your most important auditing tool.
I want to go back to the Wayback Machine in the heyday of open data. You know, the promise of open data in the earliest days is that if you put data in the hands of community, one person might have a really good idea, and that open data might uncork that good idea, right? Same thing in our engagement processes. You know, if you only focus on themes of similarity, there might be one person, only one person who had an idea, but there might be a real gem in there, right? So the big themes matter, but paying attention to different points of view or singular points of view sometimes is the beginning of something that could be really helpful to the place where you live, right? So keeping hold of that belief. Like when we're teaching planning students about civic engagement, the thing we say is like, if you don't fundamentally believe that like you can learn something from your community members when you do this process, you shouldn't be asking them to come. Like you have to go with an open mind. That value applies even more so when you're using technology as a tool in your public participation process. Like how are you going to find the one good thing, right? And maybe it won't be there, but you have to look. Right. And part of that involves doing the hard work yourself.
Yeah. Totally. I like that so much. And what you were saying, right? I mean, maybe the little inconvenient truth sometimes is we've been having the deliberative wave, we've had the open data kind of cycle, and it's still ongoing, luckily. But it might be, you know, the fact that we stand here ready for social interaction, and then there's not very many people coming at the moment, right? We have so many actually sorrows and so on. So I think part of this is also really to reiterate, like you just did, Pamela, to really project confidently and sincerely this readiness for interaction with the people, for having actually real life, also social participation, to project also as a public government, really the readiness to be open, to invite even the slightest and smallest input sometimes, that it's not only about aggregating the big numbers. And that could be maybe one of the answers of really getting people back into the process here.
The people-centered smart city it's not for people, it's with people, right? Yeah. You know, that old rallying cry, nothing about us without us. Like, that needs to be on everyone. That's a sticker or a post-it note on everyone's computer, right? With, not for. And the AI tools make the for part a lot easier, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, those are basically already great closing remarks. So I just want to ask at the end, is there any other aspect that you maybe want to raise, or otherwise, I would invite you to share just one last sense of urgency that really sets the priority. With all that we've been covering, is there anything that really should be the number one thought of urban planners when facing AI?
Well, I'm going to just insert one other thing that we didn't talk about before. I just end with a kind of a summary thought. But we also have to, we shouldn't ignore the environmental costs in all of this. So we didn't talk at all about how, you know, as we're learning, AI systems, you know, consume very significant amounts of energy and carbon and water. And there's debate about this, but I think that that's fairly unquestionable. And, you know, that might matter to cities that are maybe pursuing net zero goals, and it matters to many community members as well. So I think that that has to be part of the cost benefit calculus when we're thinking about using these tools. So I just wanted to make sure that we address that, because we didn't get a chance to yet. But I think just, you know, as a closing thought, the big takeaway for me is keeping the friction in and keeping the people in and centered in the process. And I think planning as a profession has a really unique responsibility here. So in this white collar profession, it's much more than just AI as a productivity tool or whatever. You know, for us, the use of AI and the processes that really shape the futures of communities, that's like a unique and a special responsibility there. So, you know, planners are at this kind of interface between governments, decision makers, and the public. And so when this kind of technology enters that space, it's becoming an intermediary in, you know, democracy and in democratic relationships. So there's opportunities where these tools can help, but just a reminder, you know, that the process itself often matters just as much as the outcome. So just cautioning against automating away all of the friction and the hard human and relational work, you know, and navigating different perspectives. That's where trust gets built. That's where democracy actually happens. So it's really important that we keep people in this process, you know, real people, real disagreement. And there aren't really any shortcuts to good community engagement.
You know, I think it's all of our obligations, whether we're planners or elected officials, to embrace innovation, but in a way that upholds civic values. Right? It's not innovation for innovation's sake, but how do we harness the power of innovation towards the things that matter? But to figure out the things that matter, we need to continue to work together to articulate the common future that we want. I'll also just say, like, as a thanks as we end, you know, I think the International Smart Cities Network is a really good example of how important it is to work together to try to make sense of the hard work that lies ahead. You know, our students are like, I always say to them, like, there's no more low-hanging fruit. It's all been picked. The work that we're going to do together, the challenges that we're facing are all hands-on-deck challenges, right? So we need to make time and space to share ideas, to talk about success, and also talk about failure, or to raise questions about things that are dilemmas, and roll up our sleeves and start to share. And so I know, like, working with Morgan, we've been able to put complementary but different work together. And it's really fruitful. And I'll just make a plea that, you know, part of what we do, you know, technology is going to help us be more efficient, but it's not going to help us carry the weight of democratic responsibility. And so that's work that we need to do together.
Thank you so much. Yeah, totally. I was thinking just provocatively, I think I like so much these two final big thoughts of yours. Probably every friction, as annoying as it might be sometimes in real life interaction, if you think that with the counterfactual of only having like the AI interface and not that friction, probably actually this annoying friction is something you would really appreciate rather than just sitting in front of basically a machine that prompts you all the answers. So to really repeat that to yourself is a great practice of reflecting on this and taking more inspiration for the urban planning practice into the future. Thank you so much for this great conversation. I enjoyed this a lot, and I hope, yeah, that we'll be staying in touch. I hope that also the folks out there in our network and beyond like this very much, and let's stay engaged, let's stay with the friction and with the people while building common good-oriented smart cities and communities.
Thanks, Ina.
Thank you.